This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Au Pair by Emma Roos. Read for you by Elizabeth Sastra and Nicola Barber. 1. Seraphine, August 2017. We have no photographs of our early days, Danny and I. A six-month gap yawns in the Mays family album after we were born. No first day at school pictures for Edwin. No means of telling which of us two looked more like him at the beginning. An empty double page marks the overwhelming grief that followed our arrival. It's a muggy evening at Summerbourne, and the unopened window in the study muffles the distant rasp of the sea and leaves my skin clammy. I've spent the day creating paperwork towers that cluster around the shredder now, their elongated shadows reminding me of the graveyard. If Edwin has finished his packing, he'll be waiting for me downstairs. He disapproves of me doing this so soon, or perhaps disapproves of me doing it at all. The swivel chair tilts with me as I grab another photo wallet from the bottom desk drawer. More landscape shots of my father's, I expect. And I focus on the wall calendar as I straighten, counting red-rimmed squares. 20 days since my father's accident. 8 days since his funeral. The packet flaps open and spills glossy black negatives across the carpet, and my jaw tightens. I've lost count of how many days since I last slept. The first photo is of Edwin on the beach as a child, and I check the date on the back. June 1992, just weeks before Danny and I were born. I study this four-year-old version of my big brother for any sign of awareness of the family catastrophe that was looming, but of course there is none. He's laughing, squinting against the bright sunlight, pointing a plastic spade toward a dark-haired young woman at the edge of the image. Photos of seagulls and sunsets follow, and I shuffle through them until I reach the final picture. A domestic scene both recognisable and unfamiliar. The hairs at the base of my skull prickle, and I hold my breath, and the air in the room presses closer as if it too is straining to absorb the details. We grew up with no photos of our early days, Danny and I. Yet here is our mother, sitting on the patio at Summerbourne, her face tilted down toward a swaddled baby cradled in her arms. Here is our father, standing on one side of her. Young Edwin on the other side, both beaming proudly at the camera. I bend closer over the image. My mother, before she left us. The details of her expression are hazy, the picture poorly focused, yet she radiates a calm composure from the neatness of her hair, the angle of her cheek, the curve of her body around the single infant. She shows none of the wild-eyed distress that has always haunted my imagination in the absence of anyone willing to describe her final hours to me. I flip the photo over, and my father's distinctive scrawl confirms it was taken on the day we were born, just over 25 years ago. I already know it could be no later, because on the same day Danny and I were born, our mother jumped from the cliffs behind our house and killed herself. My bare feet make no noise on the stairs. A duffel bag lurks by the hall table, snagging at my dressing gown as I sweep past. I find Edwin leaning against the wooden countertop in the unlit kitchen, gazing through the wide glass doors toward the shadows in the garden. Look at this. I flick on the lights. I've never seen this before. He takes the picture, blinking.
Me neither, he says.
He studies it.
The day you were born. I didn't know we had this, but yeah.
I think I remember it being taken. It's the first time I've seen him smile in days. Dad looks so young. Look at that. Mum looks so... happy, I say. Yeah. His tone is soft, his attention absorbed in the picture. Not like someone who's about to commit suicide. His smile fades. I twitch the picture from his fingers and scrutinize it. Why is she only holding one of us? Is it me or Danny?
I've no idea.
What's this one? Edwin reaches for the other photo I brought down, him laughing on the beach with the dark-haired teenager. Oh, this was Laura. I remember her. She was nice. Your au pair? I ask. Now that he says her name, I'm pretty sure I've seen her in the family photo album. The young woman who looked after Edwin in those carefree days before we were born, when he still had a mother, and no need of the full-time roster of nannies that Danny and I grew up with. She's the one who took this, Edwin says, reaching again for the photo of our mother holding the single baby. But I keep my grip on it and take it with me to the kitchen table. I drop onto a chair and straighten the picture in front of me, smoothing a curled corner with my thumb. It's odd, I say. It's staged, like you were marking the occasion. You'd think they'd have made sure both of us were in it. Edwin shakes his head.
I don't know. I guess there was other stuff going on we don't know about.
But Mum looks so calm here. I frown at the picture. I know. I do know why we never had any baby photos. Everyone in shock after Mum died. But I can't believe I finally found one. And I don't even know if it's me or Danny in it.
Here, Edwin says. I'll take it. I'll ask Gran about it.
He reaches for it again, but I press my thumb more firmly onto the corner. Gran never wants to talk about these things, I say. No one ever does. Edwin sighs.
You need to get some sleep, Seth. Do you want to try one of Gran's pills? Maybe get dressed tomorrow, go out for a walk or something.
He rubs his eyes briefly.
Things will get easier, you know.
Do you think we could find Laura? I ask him. If she's the one who took the picture, maybe she could tell us. I bend closer over the image, gazing at my mother's hair, the way she cradles the baby. This was literally a few hours before Mum died, wasn't it? This was the day everything here changed.
Seraphine, Edwin says.
I look up at him. And we don't know why. And now Dad's gone. We might never... The injustice of our situation, of growing up without a mother and now losing our father in such a senseless accident, comes crashing down on me again. Edwin's gaze travels from my unwashed hair to the coffee stain on my dressing gown, and then he squeezes his eyes shut.
Okay. I'm going to stay another night. I can't leave you like this. I'll ring work first thing and explain.
No. I slide the photo away across the table and roll my shoulders, stretching my neck. Don't be silly. I'm fine, honestly. I guess I was... just wondering, really, where Laura went. Afterward. Edwin watches me. I concentrate on relaxing my facial muscles, dredging up an expression of unconcerned interest. He sighs again.
She left after Mum died.
I've no idea where she went. And she'd be, what, in her 40s by now, even if you knew where she was. Couldn't just turn up on her doorstep complaining that one of you got missed out of a photo 25 years ago. She'd think you were nuts. I nod, and Edwin pushes himself off from the countertop, heading to the hall. The corner of the photo lifts again, and I draw it slowly back toward me.
But if she could tell us what happened?
He pauses in the doorway.
We know what happened, Seth. Mum was ill. She took her own life. We can't change that.
I press my lips together. Do you want me to stay? He asks.
I can stay another night. Or, look, pack a bag and come back with me. Go out with Danny tomorrow. Have lunch with Gran. Take your mind off things.
I grit my teeth. For almost 3 weeks, I've had my brothers and my grandmother staying at Summerbourne with me, handling funeral arrangements and solicitors and condolence visits. I can't begin to express to Edwin how desperately thirsty I am now for solitude.
No, honestly, I'm fine, I say. You need to go. It's late.
I fold my hands in my lap and try to smile at him.
I'll go to bed now. I might come up at the weekend.
Joel's staying at Michael's. I could ask him to look in on you. Check you're okay.
I can't suppress a groan.
Oh, please don't.
I'd found it awkward enough shaking Joel's hand at Dad's funeral. I hadn't realised he was staying with his grandfather, our old gardener, Michael, just down the lane.
Well, could you ask someone over tomorrow?
Edwin asks.
A friend? Someone from work?
His gaze slides away as I shrug. I've never felt much need for friendships, never nurtured them, and this baffles my big brother. I think of the phrase Danny uses about Edwin occasionally.
He's not disappointed in you, Seraphine. He's disappointed for you.
Danny's wry tone softening the thorny truth of it. Not for the first time, I swallow down my frustrated response. I'm fine as I am, Edwin. Leave me alone. I allow him to hug me at the front door, leaning against him for a moment, inhaling the honeysuckle scent of the fabric conditioner that our grandmother uses on our clothes when she stays here. When I pull back, I keep my gaze lowered to avoid having to look at the tension creases around his eyes.
Get some sleep, Seth, he says.
I will.
Back in the stale air of the study, I switch on the overhead light and eye up the paper towers. An image of a blue company logo niggles in my memory. I start on the documents that I cleared from the bottom drawer of the filing cabinet this morning, and within 5 minutes, I'm holding the au pair agency form, faded ink on flimsy paper. Laura Silveira was 18 years old in 1991, and her home address was in London. I type her name into my phone, then try the address, but come up with nothing that convincingly fits a woman who worked here as an au pair over 25 years ago. I carry the form down to the sitting room and pull out the family photo album that covers 1991 and 1992, gingerly turning the pages that show life at Summerbourne during her 11 months of employment here, up until the blank double page when we were born. She appears in only half a dozen pictures. The clearest is labelled Edwin with Laura, in my mother's spiky handwriting. And as I tilt the page to peer at it more closely, the ancient adhesive gives up, and the photo slides free of its transparent cover and into my hand. I gaze at Laura's image. In the other pictures, she's on the margins, glancing away, the focus on Edwin, and frequently his best friend Joel. In this one, she smiles at the camera as she holds Edwin's hand in front of the rock pools. She's tall, athletic, with a mass of dark hair tied back. The agency document says she was taking a year out to repeat her A-level exams following difficult circumstances at home. I study her face. Where there complex emotions within her smile? To me, she simply looks happy. The sun has set, but the heat of the August day lingers. I prop the family photo on my bedside table, and the eyes of my so much younger father and brother follow me as I roam restlessly around my room. It was never a taboo subject exactly, my mother's suicide, but we were only given a limited amount of information as we were growing up. Seeing her in this picture, gazing calmly down at her indistinct bundle, contradicts everything I've ever imagined about that day, and reminds me forcibly that there's no chance now of ever hearing the full details from my dad. But if Laura was there, if Laura saw what happened between this photo being taken and our mother jumping, perhaps I don't have to spend the rest of my life not knowing after all. I shove the previous night's nest of sheets off the bed and stretch out flat on my back, my fingers splayed as I wait for a hint of breeze from the open window. Inside the red-black of my eyelids flicker the faces of children who were a few years above me at the village school. Sly-tongued kids who used to call us the Sprite twins and ask me repeatedly why I didn't look like my brothers. Vera, my grandmother, used to tell me they only taunted me because I reacted with fury, unlike Danny, who could shrug any teasing off with a laugh. Bird chatter rouses me, creeping through my window with the first rays of sunlight, and I'm not sure whether I was asleep a moment ago or just lost in my thoughts. A plan is already unfurling behind my gritty eyelids. By 7 o'clock, I'm showered and dressed, with more energy and purpose in my limbs than I felt in the 3 weeks since Dad died. I tap Laura's old postcode into my GPS and join the flow of traffic from the coast to the capital, a 3-hour journey that often swells to 4. Laura's old address turns out to be a neat, terraced house with a semicircle of brightly stained glass in its front door. There's a small park across the road, surrounded by green painted railings that gleam in the late morning sunshine as if they've just been polished. I hesitate on the pavement, imagining suspicious eyes watching me from behind the pristine net curtains. For several heartbeats, I consider walking away, but I grit my teeth and knock. The man who answers is grinning before I even finish my question. "I'm looking for a Laura Silveira who lived here 25 years ago. Do you happen to know where I might find her?" He has a large hooked nose and a bald head, and he fills the narrow doorway.
"You from that posh family she used to live with?"
he asks. I blink at him. His gaze travels over my linen shift dress down to my cream ballet pumps, and he curls his lips, still grinning.
"Wait there, I'll get her mum. She knows where she works."
He shuts the door in my face. Water drips from a hanging basket of petunias next to the door, and an earthy puddle shimmers on the block paving underneath. Traffic at the top of the road drowns any sound from within the house. I prefer a quick answer, but part of me hopes Laura's mum will query my intentions first. I'd like to think my own mother wouldn't have handed out my details to a stranger. A memory niggles at me. My grandmother Vera scolding me when I was a teenager for passing on an acquaintance's phone number without their explicit permission. The door swings open, and it's the man again, a slip of paper poking out from between his thick fingers. I glimpse cream-carpeted stairs rising behind him, a large circular mirror on the wall, but no woman. No inquisitive maternal figure come to question me. The man narrows his eyes at me and pulls the door closer to his body.
"That's where she works."
He keeps his grip on the paper for a moment as I try to take it.
"Is she in trouble again?"
I shake my head. "No, not at all," he grunts.
Tell her to ring her mum, yeah?
I will. Thanks. As soon as he lets go, I fold the paper into my damp palm and hurry away. The address takes me to a grey three-storey office building on a street in northeast London, and a parking space comes free just as I approach, as if reassuring me that my visit is within the bounds of reasonable behaviour. Once parked, I clamber into the back seat, and my tinted rear windows let me peer into the reception area without being seen. I study the receptionist. She springs off her stool behind her high desk to fetch some papers, and I'm convinced she's not Laura. She's not tall enough. Not old enough. A dusty pavement lies between us, as well as three shallow steps and a pair of tall glass doors that slide open and shut periodically as people enter and leave. I stroke the curved corner of my phone with my thumb, silently rehearsing what I plan to say to Laura. My name is Seraphine Mays. You used to be my brother Edwin's au pair. Our father just died. I squeeze my eyes shut against the threat of tears. I'm feeling less capable of this by the second. The first few tinny notes of an ice cream van float down from the park at the far end of the street, and an image of my brothers rises in my mind, both tall men, with the sort of open, friendly faces that people warm to instantly. For a moment, I wallow in a sensation of separateness, of being different to them, of being disconnected from everyone. I grind my teeth. This is my chance to find out what happened back at the start, on that day we were born. No one else has ever been willing to tell me the details, but Laura might. I realize I want to see Laura first. I want to see what she looks like before I approach her, before I ask her the question that might change everything. I ease out of my car and head away down the street before looping around to approach the office building from the direction of the park. A cloud of cool air embraces me as I enter.
How can I help?
The receptionist asks, her eyebrows rising into pointy arches.
I have a delivery for Laura Silveira, I say.
A young man leaning on the desk looks sideways at me, and the receptionist's gaze drops to my hands.
Where is it?
She asks. I curl my fingers.
In the van. She needs to come and check it first. We'll bring it in if she wants it.
The receptionist exchanges a glance with the young man, who coughs into his hand.
What is it then? Top secret?
She asks. I step right up to the desk, summoning my grandmother's iciest expression.
Are you going to call her down, or do you want me to go back to the depot and have my boss ring your boss?
I tap my nails on the smooth counter. The receptionist settles back in her chair slightly.
Sure, I'll call her. And you're from?
I'll wait outside, I say. I march through the glass doors and down the steps, turning left, restraining my gait to a fast walk until I'm confident I'm out of their sight. Then I cross the road and loop back, pulling my hair loose from its bun and shielding my face as I duck through the slow traffic to dive into the back of my car. I scoot across to peer through the window. The elevator doors open, but it's a grey-haired man in a shirt and tie coming out, calling something to the receptionist. My dress sticks to my skin. I wait. The elevator doors open again, and this time it's a woman. Tall, broad-shouldered, easily mid-40s. Her dark hair is tied back at the nape of her neck, and she wears black trousers and a shapeless cream blouse, flat black shoes. Her gait as she walks toward the desk seems heavy, although she's barely overweight. I can't be certain she's the same person as the fresh-faced au pair in our family photo album, but it's possible. The receptionist says something to her, and she turns and looks sharply through the glass toward the casual shoppers strolling along the pavement and the row of parked cars within which I'm hidden. I shrink down in my seat behind my tinted glass, half closing my eyes. She steps closer, and the doors slide back. And now she's standing 2 meters away, scanning left and right, frowning. There are no vans in sight. Behind her, the receptionist says something to her lanky companion, and he smirks. My nostrils flare. I study the woman through the brush of my eyelashes. No visible makeup. Strands of grey along her parting. 2 vertical frown lines between her eyes. A silver locket hangs around her neck, but there are no rings on her fingers. She ventures down the steps to look as far as she can along the street, in each direction, and her scowl gives way to something more wary. Before I have had enough of scrutinising her, she whips round and stalks back into the building, back to the elevator without even glancing toward the pair at the desk. I uncurl and rub the fingernail crescents from my palms. I have found Laura. Now that I know what she looks like, when she comes out again, I'll be able to catch her and introduce myself. I tie my hair back up, keeping my gaze fixed on the building. As 1 o'clock approaches, employees emerge from the elevator and spill out onto the street, peeling off cardigans and jackets as they squint up at the sky, pulling phones from bags and pockets. Laura doesn't reappear. Eventually, I clamber into the driver's seat and turn on the air conditioning. I can wait. If I were in Edwin's car now, I would find a spare bottle of water and emergency cereal bars in the glove compartment. If Danny were here, there's no way he'd be able to sit and wait without nipping off to buy some chips. I watch a woman saunter along the pavement, sipping from a takeout coffee cup, and my stomach shrivels. I ease my shoes off and angle my feet into the sluggish drafts from the air vents. She'll have to come out eventually. I think of my own colleagues in Norwich, eating their sandwiches in the cathedral grounds under this same cloudless sky, sharing the usual jokes after a steady morning managing the recruitment company accounts. I miss the soothing routine of my accounting job, the reliability of the numbers, the clear-cut answers. I don't suppose my boss imagines this is how I'm spending my compassionate leave. I tug the family photo from my bag and peer at the baby again. I know I was the bigger twin when we were born, amusing since Danny now towers over me, but I can't judge the size of this cocooned infant. Edwin's grin makes my throat tighten. 4 years old and oblivious to the fact that this was the last day he would ever spend with his mother. Our mother. When I think about her, I picture my heart sending out tentacles, like wriggling strawberry laces, straining to latch onto an emotion. They don't succeed. Her absence left a hollow space inside me. Laura's reappearance jolts me from my thoughts. She strides from the elevator and within seconds is out on the pavement, sweeping past me, marching toward the park. I slip my shoes back on and ease out of the car to follow her. She glances back over her shoulder once, just before she turns into the park. But by the time I reach the gate, half a minute later, she's vanished. A path bisects the expanse of grass, and people lounge around, finishing picnics on either side. But Laura is nowhere in sight. There's a second gate farther along the boundary with the street. I set off toward it, keeping to the narrow band of shade by the hedge as my eyes seek out potential hiding places. Behind the bandstand? Among those trees? Back out in the fume-filled street, I still can't see her, I rub the back of my neck. Across the road is a small newsagent, and while I queue to pay for a bottle of water, I continue to scan the pavement outside. A hand on my bare arm makes me flinch.
You dropped this?
A woman in a headscarf says to me, holding out a coin and ducking away from my expression. The photo, the one with my mother in it, still lies on the passenger seat of my car when I return. And I drop into the driver's seat and turn the picture face down. I thought I was being so clever, but I've messed it all up. I start the engine and sit for a moment, gripping the steering wheel, an uneasy thought prickling underneath my frustration. If I contact Laura properly now, ring her, ask to meet her, will she guess it was me who called her down for a non-existent delivery today? Did she spot me trying to follow her? Will she ever agree to talk to me now? 21 days since my father's accident. 9 days since his funeral. I can't make any decisions sitting in my roasting car on this tired, dusty street. I wipe my palms on my dress and tap Summerbourne into the GPS. I'll be able to think about it all more clearly when I get home.
2. Laura, August 1991. Green gauges. I always associated my first visit to Summerbourne with those shy green plums, whose ordinary-looking skins hide such astonishing sweetness. In my 18 years as a city girl, I had never even seen a green gage, but they grew abundantly in the woodland at the back of the Summerbourne garden, and I devoured several that day. They tasted of honey and sunshine and new beginnings. The full English breakfast at King's Cross Station earlier that morning had settled my nerves for a while, but as midday drew near and the train rumbled deeper into the Norfolk countryside, the fluttering under my ribcage increased. I pressed my forehead against the window. Broad, flat fields stretched to the horizon, punctuated by eerily motionless villages and odd isolated houses topped with thatch. Somewhere in the depths of my handbag lurked a cheese sandwich intended for this section of the journey, but the upcoming interview had chased away my appetite. At King's Lynn, I clutched the letter from Mrs. Mays in front of me as I approached the taxi rank, even though the address for Summerbourne House was already fixed in my memory in its spiky letters. The taxi driver's bowels rolled and stretched in his mouth, leaving a heartbeat's delay before they settled into words I could understand. I fumbled the letter across to him.
"Oh, Summerbourne, is it?"
he said. I climbed into the back. Despite the roads having only one lane in either direction, we hurtled along between high hedges, as if he had a sixth sense for hazards around bends.
"That's just down the drift here,"
he said eventually, his tone encouraging, as we left yet another village behind us and swung into a narrow lane. I wound my window down, unsure whether my churning stomach was a reaction to the twisting roads, the looming interview, or the sudden fear that I didn't have enough money in my wallet to pay him. A heavy, sweet smell filled the car as we passed a field of cows, and the lane curved to reveal a row of small cottages with low front doors, their walls studded with irregular grey stones. Just as I became convinced the lane was narrowing into a dead end, we reached a sign for Summerbourne inviting us to turn right. The driveway widened into an oval of golden gravel in front of the most entrancing house I had ever seen. From the buttery glow of its weathered bricks to the rounded edges of its broad stone doorstep, every detail of Summerbourne radiated a warm welcome. Lush greenery stretched along the front of the house on either side of the central front door, glossy leaves stroking the ground floor windowsills. The front door knocker was a large brass ring, solid and plain. There was none of the adornment I had seen on grand London houses, but this only enhanced the impression that Summerbourne sat contentedly in its own bricks and mortar. A long single-story wing stretched from one side of the house, angled backward, its sharper corners hinting at more recent origins. From the far end of this wing, a high wall curved to join a stable block that stood at right angles to the main house, fronting onto the oval of gravel. Three of the four stable doorways were fitted with wooden garage doors. I forgot my anxiety as I stood by the taxi and absorbed the view, and my smile must have revealed my genuine delight to the small dark-haired woman who emerged from the front door. "Mrs. Mays?" I asked. "Call me Ruth," she said, and paid the taxi driver without fuss. She had an unhurried manner about her, friendly, but as if part of her attention was elsewhere. A little boy had followed her out and peered at me from behind her legs as the taxi purred away down the lane. This child was the reason I had travelled all this way, and I crouched on the gravel in front of him. "Hello, I'm Laura. Are you Edwin?" He nodded. "Did you come on the train?" "I did." I tugged my handbag open and rummaged through the contents. "Look, here's my ticket. Would you like it?" I wasn't particularly used to young children, and I'd never seen anyone's mood change so quickly. He snatched the ticket and whirled around, whooping, waving it in the air, before catching Ruth's eyes and pausing to say, "Thank you." Then he launched into a garbled story about a train journey he had taken with his granny, what the guard had said, how fast they'd travelled, what all the different carriages had been for. Ruth smiled at me over his head. "Let's show you around." She indicated the single-story extension as we approached the front door of the house. "That's the day nursery, there, and the annex at the end of it. We'll start in there." She led me from the hall, through the kitchen and utility room, into the vast, light-filled day nursery that made up the majority of the extension. A row of floor-to-ceiling windows looked out over a wide lawn that ended in trees in the distance. I tore my gaze from the scene and hurried to catch up with Ruth and Edwin as they paused at the door at the far end of the room. "The annex," Ruth said, pushing the door open and gesturing me in first. "Did the agency explain the hours? We just want some part-time childcare. We're quite flexible. The other girl I interviewed thought we were too far out in the middle of nowhere." She sighed. "We've never had an au pair before." I looked around at the high ceilings, the white walls, the generous windows. "I've never been an au pair before," I said, and then gritted my teeth as I realised this reply was hardly reassuring. Ruth didn't appear to notice. Edwin slipped his hand into mine. "I'll show you everything, Mrs. Laura Sylvie. There's a bed in the bedroom, and there was a ginormous spider in the bathroom, but it's gone to live in the woods now." The furniture was heavy-looking and old, but the rooms were bright and spotlessly clean, and I was glad of Edwin's non-stop chatter as he showed me around. I was primed and ready to answer questions about my limited childcare experience, but I struggled for the right reaction to this casual tour. "It's all so beautiful," I said. Ruth indicated the cooktop and fridge in the corner of the sitting room. "The kitchen in the main house will always be available. We're happy for the au pair to eat with us, or not, whichever they fancy." We retraced our steps, and this time paused in the day nursery long enough for me to take in its contents. Bookcases bulged with games and toys, and there was a large table covered in art equipment, along with two battered sofas and a television and video recorder. "He does like to play outside as much as possible," Ruth said, "but this room's handy for when you want a quiet hour or two." The whole ground floor of Mum's house would have fitted inside it. We rejoined the main part of the house through a utility room that opened into the kitchen. Edwin's artwork covered a corkboard on one wall and paintbrushes mingled with cutlery on the drainer. Double glass doors opened onto a patio, and I followed Ruth outside, squinting through a dazzle of whirling lawn sprinklers to spot some wooden play equipment in the far corner where the perfectly trimmed grass met the trees. "We've had a difficult couple of years," Ruth said, as Edwin ran ahead to reach his climbing frame. "I'm looking for someone to keep him company and play with him when I can't. Most mornings and some afternoons, but I'm quite flexible. No evenings or weekends, unless mutually agreed and for extra pay." "It sounds great," I said. "It doesn't sound like work, to be honest."
"Wait till he's telling you the train story for the 30th time."
She gave me a quick smile. "But no, he's just full of energy. He needs to be outside, climbing and running. But I need to know he's safe." We stopped by the play equipment and watched Edwin launch himself along the monkey bars.
"It's just for a year," she said. "He starts school next September."
"Well, I'll retake my exams next May, and then I'll be free until I start university." I tapped a strut of the climbing frame. "Touch wood."
"And you have some experience of working with children?"
I hesitated.
"A little. I've done a fair bit of babysitting for my neighbours. I like children."
I waited for her to frown, to exclaim that this wasn't enough. But she was gazing at Edwin as if her mind had already moved on.
"Watch me, Laura Sylvie!"
Edwin shouted, lining up to shoot down the slide head first on his back. He had a full start, so I went over to help him. We continued our stroll through the garden, slowing at the edge of the woodland to pick our way over the scattered fallen fruit that Ruth told me were greengages. Hundreds more of them hung from the branches overhead, and Ruth and I picked several, passing some to Edwin. They were perfectly ripe, and all three of us exclaimed over their heavenly flavour, spitting the stones away into the undergrowth and wiping our mouths with our hands. The tension in my stomach began to ease. My early impression of Ruth was of someone self-contained and calm, with a controlled way of moving and speaking. I worried at first that her reserved manner meant she didn't like me, but as we followed the winding path through the trees, I began to suspect this was her natural personality, and I found myself warming to her. She seemed to forget she was meant to be interviewing me. She complained good-naturedly when she caught cobwebs in her hair, and was gentle in her handling of an earthworm that Edwin presented her with. I examined her in brief, sideways glances. Below average height, and delicate-boned, she was the physical opposite of me. I wondered whether she was always this pale. Perhaps it was due to the difficult time she had mentioned. They showed me the tall iron gate in the back of the boundary wall, but we didn't have time to go out to the cliffs and see the sea. "Next time," Ruth said. I was returning her smile before the full implication of her words sank in, and then the remaining tension in my stomach melted away. We toured the vegetable garden and the apple orchard on our circular route back toward the house, and Ruth introduced me to the gardener, Mr. Harris. With his thick white hair and leathery skin, he had the appearance of a person who'd lived outdoors his whole life.
"Mr. Michael Harris is Joel's granddad," Edwin told me.
"You'll have passed his cottage in the lane," Ruth said. The older man nodded at me, and I smiled back. I used to love helping my aunt in the garden of her little bungalow, before Mum fell out with her and I was banned from visiting. When Michael slid open the greenhouse door for Edwin to pick a handful of sun-warmed tomatoes, I leaned in to inhale the earthy aroma of humid green growth. The biggest surprise came at the end of our walk. Sheltered by the back wall of the stable block, encircled by faded timber decking and a hedge of lavender, was a glorious turquoise-tiled swimming pool. The water sparkled invitingly in the August sunshine.
"You're a swimmer, aren't you?"
Ruth asked. Although the solar heating's pretty puny, I'm afraid. You have to be fairly tough to bear it. I smiled. I taught myself to swim at a Lido when I was 10. It was freezing, but you get used to it. And you swim competitively now? I did, yes, until my exams, the last few months. I squinted at a single green leaf floating on the surface of the pool. I love it. I'm glad, Ruth said. I'd much prefer to have someone who's a strong swimmer. To keep Edwin safe, you know. I looked at the little boy. What do you reckon, Edwin? Do you think we're brave enough to swim in a bit of cold water? Edwin did a wild dance to show his enthusiasm for the idea, and Ruth laughed. Do you have any questions? Ruth asked me, and then, have you had lunch? We had ours before you arrived. Come and sit on the patio, and I'll bring some tea out. The patio furniture was more substantial than Mum's three-piece suite at home, with sturdy wooden frames and deep cushions. Stone urns brimmed with orange marigolds and blue lobelia. Along with the tea, Ruth carried out a plate laden with squares of chocolate tiffin, cinnamon pastries, and slices of carrot cake with thick lemon frosting. Edwin scampered off to his sandpit with a piece of tiffin cake, and Ruth poured the tea. I was very impressed by your references from your school, she said. I'd like to offer you the job, Laura. I do hope you'll say yes. I think you and Edwin would get on extremely well together. I fumbled with my saucer. Yes, please, I said. Thank you. That's brilliant. Lovely, she said. Can you start a week from Monday? I was finishing my second slice of cake when the peace of the garden was interrupted by sounds drifting over from the front of the house. Tires crunched over gravel and a door slammed. Ruth made a noise in her throat. My mother's taxi, she said. She didn't get up. Technically, this is her house, and she likes to keep an eye on what goes on. She was angling to meet you. Sorry. She must have caught my expression because she added, Oh, don't worry. She doesn't visit that often. She comes down from London once or twice a month on the train. Anyway, she'll adore you. I'm sure of it. Granny! Edwin hurtled toward the woman who stepped out onto the patio, his arms outstretched. Her sleek bob of dark hair was immaculate, her white blouse pristine, but she dropped her handbag and swung the little boy up and hugged him to her chest, laughing. Hello, my darling boy. I brushed cake crumbs from my lap as I stood. Mother, this is Laura Silvera, Ruth said, remaining seated. Laura, this is Vera Blackwood, my mother. Vera's handshake was firm, and I braced myself against her appraising expression, struck by an unsettling conviction that she understood more about my personality and my background from that brief greeting than Ruth did after an hour of talking to me. I wondered whether Vera had met the other girl Ruth said she'd interviewed. I found myself scrutinizing Vera in return, wondering how it felt to own a house like this, and yet live elsewhere. Vera's direct gaze softened when she smiled, and she nodded as she released my hand. She turned to Ruth. Sorry to interrupt your interview, darling. How are you getting along? I've offered Laura the job. She's perfect. Vera's smile widened. How wonderful. I'm so glad to meet you, Laura. Edwin is our pride and joy, and we do so want him to be happy. Ruth gave an exaggerated blink and turned to watch Edwin practicing handstands on the lawn. Ruth? Vera tilted her head as she scrutinized her daughter. You look tired, darling. How are you feeling? Ruth sighed. I do have a bit of a headache, actually. This sun doesn't help. I might go and lie down now, if you don't mind, Laura. Not at all, I said. Of course. I'm so glad you're going to come and live with us. Ruth kept her hand on her forehead as she stood. Just let me know which date suits you to move in. Maybe next weekend? Mother can call a taxi to take you back to the station when you're ready. Oh, but
I stopped, ducking my head as they both looked at me. I mean, it's a shame, that's all, that the other taxi just left. I should have gone in that one. Heat rose to my cheeks. Ruth looked at me blankly, but Vera waved away my concern with a gentle smile.
Not to worry, Vera said. Ruth, you go and lie down, and I'll ring for the taxi and keep Laura company until it gets here.
Edwin trotted into the house after them, and I stayed on the patio, fanning myself with a picture book from the table. When Vera returned, she brought a jug of cold juice with her, and she sent Edwin off to eat a popsicle on the lawn so as not to drip it on the cream cushions. She poured me a glass and asked me a few questions about my school and my swimming squad.
I'm so glad Ruth likes you, she said. She can be rather overprotective of Edwin sometimes, unsurprisingly, after what happened to his brother. Did she tell you?
I shook my head, the glass at my lips. She twisted the rings on her fingers.
Edwin had a twin brother. He died the December before last, in an accident.
The liquid caught in the back of my throat, making me cough. I covered my mouth with my hand, staring at her.
No.
She closed her eyes for a moment.
It was just after their second birthday. I thought you ought to know. We all miss him terribly, of course. But Ruth has found it particularly difficult, because she blames herself.
Her tone was matter of fact. I couldn't find any words.
Ruth can be a little unpredictable at times, she continued. I'm hoping she'll get better once you're here. She doesn't like me coming over too often, and Dominic's in the city for work during the week, of course. It's rather lonely for her, although she says that's the way she likes it.
I watched her twist her rings, struggling to follow her words, the horror of Edwin losing his brother pulsating in my mind. She paused to scrutinize my face for a moment.
I think you'll be perfect for her.
Edwin brought his popsicle stick to the table and then scampered back to practice forward rolls on the lawn.
My number's in the book on the hall table if you ever need to ring me, Vera said. Ah, that's the taxi.
She rose in one smooth movement.
Edwin, darling, come and say goodbye to Laura. She has to go now.
Edwin slid his sticky hand into mine as we walked through the kitchen and hall and out to the drive. Vera held her purse in front of her.
When are you coming back, Mrs. Laura Sylvie?
Edwin asked. I cleared my throat, squashing Vera's words to the back of my mind and concentrating on the serious blue eyes gazing up at me.
You can call me Laura,
I told him, smiling. I looked at Vera. If I'm starting a week from Monday,
shall we say Saturday the 7th?
She said. Give you time to get settled.
Yes, great.
I gave Edwin a quick hug and climbed into the taxi while Vera paid the driver.
Safe journey,
she called as we pulled away. I waved to the two of them, craning my neck to keep the golden bricks of the house in sight for as long as possible. The green gauge in my pocket I would savor on the train home. I had just over a week to pack and say goodbye to my friends, most of whom were starting new jobs or themselves packing for university.
Then I could put my old London life behind me and dive into the year at Summerbourne that glittered ahead.
Ruth and Vera had both said I was perfect for the job. As far as I could see, the job was perfect for me.
3. Seraphine. Despite my failure to speak to Laura, despite the sharp ache of missing my father, my spirits rise as I drive that last mile to Summerbourne, through the village and out the other side, down the winding lane, cruising between the hedges where we picked blackberries as children, past the flint cottages with their windows propped open, swinging right onto the driveway. Apart from the 3 years I spent living in shared student houses in Liverpool, Summerbourne is the only home I've ever known. My stomach growls, but I stay in the car for a minute more, contemplating the familiar yellow bricks in front of me, my gaze skimming over the peeling paint on the windowsills and the nettles in the front beds. Danny and I were the first children to be born in the summer months here for several generations, and despite the summer-born surname having been lost via female inheritance many years ago, we grew up proud of being called the summer-born summer-borns. It made up for the less friendly nicknames anyway. As well as summer-born, my grandmother Vera inherited a smart London house called Winterbourne, apparently renamed as such to amuse a summer-born ancestor. When Vera decided a few years ago that she'd prefer the amenities of a luxury city apartment, she gave Winterbourne to Edwin, making the announcement on his 25th birthday. It's perfect for him, close to his work in Canary Wharf, and he's always made it clear that Danny and I can stay there whenever we want, even gave us our own keys. But the question of Summerbourne's fate festers inside me like an abscess. I try to wall it off and ignore it, but at moments of weakness, it swells and erupts and gnaws away at me. Last month, as Danny and I approached our 25th birthday, I wondered whether Vera was considering giving the house to one of us, or both of us. How could it be done fairly? And then Dad died the day before we turned 25. And I haven't given it another thought until now, mulling it over here on the drive. I'm the one who still lives here, and I'm the one who dreams of always living here. I can picture myself growing old at Summerbourne, and although I used to dream of falling in love and sharing it with someone else, I'm perfectly resigned now to living here by myself. Edwin has Winterbourne. Vera has her shiny new city apartment. Dad had his own flat in London when he was alive. Danny works abroad a lot and shows no sign of wanting to settle anywhere. I'm the one who still lives here. I'm the one who loves this house the most. I fix my eyes firmly on the round door knocker as I leave my car, determined not to glance toward the patch of gravel in front of the garages where last month they had to hose Dad's blood away. The air inside the house is even warmer than outside, and I fling open windows and back doors. Edwin left food in the fridge for me, and I reheat a bowl of pasta and carry it out to the patio. The lawn is an uneven patchwork of yellow and brown, parched and dejected. The gardening company that Vera hired after Michael retired a few years ago has never come close to recreating the lush green velvet that Michael achieved seemingly effortlessly. My phone vibrates with a text from Edwin. How's your day been? I consider ringing him, but I can't face confessing that I tracked down his old au pair today, that I tricked her and followed her and then lost her. I picture Laura's expression as she looked up and down the street, her irritation sliding into unease. Fine, I text back. Tired, going to bed. The sky is still light, and I prowl into the kitchen for a beer, deciding instead on a hot chocolate in the hope the warm milk might make me sleepy. I reach for a mug from the shelf, grab the powder from the cupboard, pluck a spoon from the drawer, all without having to really look. Nothing has changed in this kitchen since I used to do this as a child, even as far back as the days when I needed to stand on a chair to reach the mugs and was obliged to ask Edwin or Joel or one of the nannies to heat my milk in the microwave. I start to carry my hot chocolate toward the day nursery, old childhood habits resurfacing. But then I shake my head and turn instead to the sitting room. A faint breeze from the open window stirs the curtains as I walk in. On a whim, I send a text to Vera. Hi, Gran. Do you fancy coming down to Summerbourne tomorrow? I could pick you up from the station. I have one of Edwin's quiches in the fridge. Love, Seth. Kiss. Surely, Vera must have raced over here that day when she heard Danny and I had been born, excited to see her new grandchildren? Perhaps, now that Dad's gone, she will agree to share some more details of that day with me. Perhaps she can explain why one of us was missing from the photo and what happened to drive our mother to take her own life. I wonder about Laura, where she lives, what she's doing right now. I'm torn between frustration at her for evading me today and a reluctant sympathy after seeing how carelessly the hook-nosed man and her own mother gave up her details. What sort of a life has she had, with people like that as family? I rub my temples. Maybe right now Laura is immersed in the distractions of her own busy home, overseeing homework, cooking with teenagers, opening a bottle of wine with her husband. I chew my lip. Or perhaps she's worrying about hoax deliveries and stalkers. I turn on the television in an attempt to focus on something else, but the phrase, "poor little orphan," bursts out, and I hit the off button savagely, hurling the remote control across the sofa. And then my phone vibrates with a reply from Vera.
"Love to, darling. Pick me up at 12.
I carry my hot chocolate up to my bedside table, where it grows a slimy skin during the night. The following day, I keep the conversation light all through lunch, until Vera and I have carried our tea out to the patio, hoping for a breeze to relieve the relentless heat. We settle in the shade, and I run my fingertips over the chipped stone rim of the plant pot next to me. A couple of the other pots hold wilting hydrangeas, but this one has only a low fuzz of weeds. Vera's gaze sweeps across the neglected lawn.
"We need to sort this garden out."
"Yeah. Gran." She starts to pour the tea.
"Hmm?
Can I ask you about Laura?" She freezes, literally holds the teapot an inch above the table and stares at it without moving. I reach out and gently push the pot down until the china clunks on the wood, and then she shakes her head slightly and sits back in her chair, her expression distant.
"Laura who?"
she says eventually. "Laura Silveira, Edwin's old au pair."
"Darling, I'd really rather not."
We sit facing the garden for a while, listening to the bees droning in the faded lavender. Vera keeps her chin high, one thumb stroking the rings on her other hand. I run my fingertips over the rough fabric of the sofa cushions, back and forth. "I'm sorry, Gran, but I can't spend my whole life not knowing about this stuff." She acknowledges this with a dip of her head.
"Well, what is it you'd like to know?"
"What was she like?" Vera sighs.
"She was a young girl who worked here a very long time ago, Seraphine. I hardly remember what she was like. Why do you want to know?"
"She was here on the day Danny and I were born?"
"She helped your mother deliver you, yes. Ruth was ridiculously resistant to the idea of calling a midwife or doctor. It was part of her illness."
"I'm sorry, Gran, to bring up bad memories. But what happened afterward? After Mum died, did Laura leave straight away? Edwin doesn't think he ever saw her again." She frowns at me.
"Why have you been discussing her with Edwin?"
"Oh, just, I found a photo in Dad's desk. It made me wonder."
"What photo?"
I jump up and fetch it from the kitchen. She puts her reading glasses on and stares at it for a long time.
"I've never seen this before," she says eventually.
"Edwin thinks he remembers it being taken by Laura.
But I don't understand why Mum looks so calm when it must have been just hours before she... I shake my head. And why there's only one of us in the picture? Why not both of us? I don't understand. The photo trembles in Vera's hand and she drops it on the table. I snatch it up again, fearful of it being damaged by a stray drop of tea, reminding myself that I must scan it tonight, save it safely in digital format. Are you all right? I ask. Yes, darling. It's just a shock to see that after all this time. It must have been taken not long before I arrived and everything happened. It's actually quite nice to see a shot of them looking so happy together. So what was Mum like when you got here? What happened? She shakes her head slowly. She was confused. Unwell. She gives me an anguished look. I'm sorry, Seraphine. I didn't know she was going to jump until it was too late. I should have saved her. I nod, pressing my lips together. The corner of the photo is damp under my thumb, and I switch to holding it by the edges. My mother's face seems more blurry than ever. Well, why do you think they took this without both of us being in it? She shakes her head slowly, her forehead creased. I can't think. Perhaps one of you was asleep and they didn't want to disturb you? Can you tell which of us it is? I hold the picture closer to her, but she keeps her hands folded on her lap. No, I'm not sure. You were bigger than Danny, of course, but I can't tell from that. It could be either one of you. Maybe it's Danny, then. It looks small to me. Maybe. I try to get in touch with Laura, I say, and then leap to my feet again as Vera starts to cough. She pushes her chair backward and half stands, bent over the table, catching her breath. Are you all right, Gran? She waves a hand at me.
Fine.
I'll get you some water. As I wait for the kitchen tap to run cold, I slide the photo between two pages of a heavy old recipe book to keep it flat. A dragonfly batters against the window, but when I push the pane open, it just skitters higher to buzz metallically at the ceiling. I fill a glass. Vera stands at the edge of the patio, looking out over the neglected lawn, her back to me. How did you find her? She asks. I went to her old address, and they told me where she works. Did you speak to her? I hesitate. No. She turns to me, and I think she's going to accuse me of lying. But she steps closer with an expression I've never seen before, as if she's fighting a swell of panic. She twists her rings around and around in front of her chest. Seraphine, listen to me. That girl almost destroyed our family. I wish to God Ruth had never employed her. Don't talk to her, Seraphine, please. I can't bear it. I'll answer any questions you have about your birth, about your mother, about anything. Just please, stay away from her. Oh, Gran, I didn't mean to upset you. My hand hovers over her arm for a moment. I weigh up her words, and then I step back. Actually, there is something else I'd like to ask you, I say. It's nothing to do with Laura. She returns to her seat, easing herself down with a huff. Go ahead, then. What are your plans for Summerborn? I ask. In the long run? Her eyes widen. What do you mean? Can't we just talk about these things, Gran? I don't mind either way, but who will get it? Danny or me? I just want to know. Seraphine. She pulls a handkerchief from the bag at her side and dabs it around her mouth. My goodness, what's got into you today? I press my lips together and look at her, and she's the first to break eye contact. There will
always be more than enough money for you to buy your own house, she says. I sway slightly and grasp the back of a chair. Are you saying that Summerbourne will go to Danny? I ask. She watches me. She gives the smallest of nods.
Why?
I whisper. She opens her mouth, but the sudden flash of pity in her eyes makes me recoil. I can't bear to be near her any longer. I have a sudden desperate need to see the sea. She calls my name, but I stride across the lawn without looking back, breaking into a run when I reach the cover of the trees, curling my fists as I pound toward the back gate. Summerbourne is my home. I'm the one who loves it the most. When we were young, Danny used to run away from home periodically, triggered more than once by one of his favourite nannies leaving. He would pack a bag with provisions and sometimes make it as far as the village before he was missed. Dad used to say Danny was ready to go off exploring the world before he even started school. I, on the other hand, resisted bonding with our nannies because I understood from a young age that sooner or later they would all leave us, just like our mother had left us. People were unreliable, but the house I was born in was a safe, solid constant. I used to pester Dad and Vera for tales of Summerbourne's history, frustrated that Dad knew so little and that Vera seemed so irritated by my questions. I drew pictures of my house obsessively and dreamed of being its queen and making all the rules. One of Dad's favourite tales was of finding me, aged 5, crying with a cut finger. Not because it hurt, he used to tell people laughing, but because I told her Summerbourne was in her blood, and she'd been peering into her wound and couldn't see any yellow brick dust. I think of Danny now, my laid-back brother, and a loud, harsh laugh escapes me, because I know already what he will say when he hears Vera's decision about Summerbourne. We can share it, Seth. You can have it, Seth. The same as he's always said about everything, our whole lives. As ever, the view from the top of the cliffs soothes me. Gulls soar and swoop farther along the coastline near the boatyard, but their cries are drowned by the hiss of the waves here on the beach below. Breeze dries my tears, and I turn my attention to the stone tower by the top of the cliff steps. The Summerbourne Folly, built by one of my ancestors, used nowadays to store our deck chairs and windbreaks for the beach. I potter around, tugging up a few weeds from the low wall that encircles the tower, bundling the prettier ones together into a bouquet. I run my fingers over the chiselled Latin words by the tower door, and then I sit in my usual spot on the scratchy grass inside the enclosure and rest my back against the warm stone wall. I think of my grandmother's face as she looked at that photo, and as she told me that Summerbourne will go to Danny. Despite her faults, I struggle to believe that Vera would favour a male heir for the sake of it. Has she made this decision because Danny has always been her favourite? Cheerful, biddable Danny, who never argued with her or resented her claustrophobic care the way I did. Or could it be something else? Could it be related to there just being one baby in that photo? Could it mean she has doubts about who I really am? I know that Dad was in London on the morning we were born, that he didn't get here until after Laura had helped my mother deliver her babies. We weren't expected until the following month, and there was nobody else in the house apart from 4-year-old Edwin. I push myself up and take my bunch of wildflowers back to the house, dropping them into an old glass vase on the kitchen table. Vera has gone, presumably in a taxi back to the station. There's a note on the hall table saying, "Please don't be cross, Seraphine. I'll see you next weekend. V. Kiss."
I scrunch it up and toss it into the trash can before dialing the number for Winterbourne. I need to talk to my brothers. I grip my teeth against the tiny voice that scratches inside my skull. But are they your brothers?
4. Laura, September 1991. Ruth and Dominic Mays met me at King's Lynn Station on my return to Norfolk just over a week later. Dominic was a tall man, all smiles and enthusiasm. He laughed when he lifted my suitcase.
What have you got in here, rocks?
Books, I said. Darling, she's here for a year, Ruth said. This is hardly anything. I tried to smile. I don't need much. Dominic opened the back door of his car with a flourish, ushering me inside.
Anything you need while you're staying with us, just ask, Laura. Edwin can't wait to see you again. He's made you about 5 welcome cards this morning already.
I glanced at the empty car seat next to me, wishing Edwin had come with them. The villagers were busier on a Saturday morning than they had been in the week, with people mowing the grass in their front gardens and walking their dogs in family groups. Driving through the last village, the one that Summerbourne sits on the far outskirts of, Dominic pointed out several landmarks.
You can walk into the village in 15 minutes or so, he said, or we can find you a bike, I'm sure. Food in the pub's okay. Basics in the shop. Bakery and butcher's down there, behind the post office. There's a little pharmacy at the back of the doctor's office.
That's the school, Ruth said, turning her head to keep it in her sight.
The preschool's in the hut at the end, Dominic said. Edwin will do a couple of mornings a week after Christmas.
He might, Ruth said.
To make some friends before he starts school, Dominic